Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. Just as Republican state legislatures across the country are working assiduously to place obstacles between the voters and the polls, so too are Republicans in Ohio working to thwart the development of commercial-scale wind and solar development. Two bills have just been passed through the legislature and then have been signed into law by the governor that attack renewable energy development from two angles. One adds burdensome administrative hoops to the permitting process for large-scale generation facilities, and the other prohibits cities from mandating the phase-out of natural gas and oil and propane for heating and cooking. Both of these bills were backed by the oil and gas industries and opposed by environmentalists and even a portion of the business community, according to my guest, Kathy Cohen-Becker, who has been active both with the Sierra Club and various other citizen action groups, and who now heads the group Simply Living. The first half of the show is my interview with her, and then we'll hear from three women from Athens, Ohio, who were arrested recently in Minnesota, where they traveled to take part in an ongoing protest over the Enbridge 3 pipeline construction. Yes, that's right, the Keystone XL pipeline, or part of it, may have been canceled with help from the Biden administration, but there are other pipelines being built now that would perform the same function as the Keystone branch, which are being met with protests by Native Americans and allies just as Keystone was. First, let's hear from Kathy Cohen-Becker. So the last time I spoke with you, it was after the Columbus City Council had voted to adopt a renewable energy plan that was really quite delightful for environmental activists who had been hoping for something like that. In fact, it kind of exceeded people's hopes and expectations at that time. I remember you were fairly jubilant about that, but now we have some state bills that may interfere. Can we backtrack a little bit, explain what the City Council voted for back then, and then we'll talk about how this differs?
Right, yeah. So what Columbus City Council did is they voted to put on the ballot an initiative that would, where the people would vote on whether or not to do community choice aggregation for 100% renewable energy. So that does require a city vote. What aggregation does, and this was for electricity, it allows the city to negotiate on behalf of the residents for a price for energy. That's an Ohio statute, and about 400 cities across Ohio have aggregation of either electricity or gas or both. What made the Columbus initiative special was that it called for 100% renewable energy. It called for that renewable energy to be supplied by new construction of in-state wind and solar projects. And then it also called for programs to be built in and folded into that would produce money for community grants, specifically for low-income neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color, for things like energy efficiency, renewable energy upgrades, and also they're talking about making a green bank with some of that money. So City Council voted to put that on the ballot. It did go on the ballot last November, and in Columbus, 76% of residents voted in favor of that. So it won by a huge landslide. I also want to note that I worked on a campaign and in Grove City to do this. The Grove City Council also put it on their ballot, also last November. And in Grove City, it passed by 63%. And they had similar stipulations about 100% renewable energy from in-state solar and wind projects.
So now a rash of bills have passed in the House and the Senate and have been signed into law by Governor DeWine, including, of course, the state budget. But there are a number of other bills which you say were standalone bills, a few of which do affect renewable energy. Can mm-hmm. you describe those and talk a little bit about their background, like who proposed them and why?
Right. There's several bills, but the two big ones, one is called Senate Bill 52. So I guess I refer to these bills as sort of the Empire Strikes Back. We made a huge strides with renewable energy with Columbus and Grove City. As a result of that, dozens of solar companies started proposing to build projects in Ohio because, you know, these cities are wanting to move to local renewable energy. Ohio is flat. It has decent sunlight. The cost of land is not as expensive as, say, in California or New York. And we have First Solar outside of Toledo that actually manufactures solar panels. So the supplies are right here, too. So that brought in a lot of companies proposing to build solar projects in the state. And that brought somewhat of a backlash, some from local people, but, you know, some just stirred up by anti-renewable energy forces. And so that eventually landed at the State House. And so Republican legislators proposed two different bills. And this will, and the way these bills are, it will show you the hypocrisy. Like, these are both anti-renewable energy, but for different reasons. So Senate Bill 52, what that does is it puts extra roadblocks in front of wind and solar projects that no fossil fuel project has to do. So the process in the Ohio Power Siting Bureau is quite extensive in terms of getting approval for any kind of energy project. It usually takes years. It takes an application that's from the developer that's often literally thousands of pages addressing every kind of environmental question you might want. There's hearings for people who live near the project at the beginning. There's hearings for them to testify at the end. There's ways to intervene legally in this. And that's normally what it goes through. And it costs these developers quite a bit of money to go through that. Well, just for solar and wind, Senate Bill 52 made these solar and wind projects subject to approval by county commissioners. County commissioners can say you can't build it here at all. They can say you can only build it in certain levels. And it can be sent to a local referendum. So they did this in the name of what they called local control. But it's only for solar and wind. It's not for any sort of fossil fuel project. And there was a lot of testimony, mainly a lot of testimony against that. And this time the environmental groups kind of took a back seat and they let the business groups lead. There's a lot of farmers groups that farmers want to be able to put these projects on their land and basically farm the energy from the sun as well as any other project. And they didn't want to have what they did with their own land subject to a referendum. Also, the solar industry and even the Columbus Partnership went and testified against this. So they got a few amendments, and one of the amendments helped grandfather in some of the currently proposed projects, but future projects will be subject to all this. But that did pass both the Senate and then it passed the House. So that was done. The rationale was supposedly local control, but at the same time, they were pushing House Bill 201. And what that does, and it was backed largely by the oil and gas industry, as you might imagine, it forbids any city from making a commitment that would phase out the use of gas in that city. And they were reacting to some laws that have passed in California where gas will no longer be allowed in new construction, like homes can't have gas stoves. And so that's, you know, kind of a larger idea of moving everything to electricity and then moving that electricity to renewable energy. And there were bills in about 12 states similar to this. Florida, Texas were two other ones. In Ohio, we had not seen any laws or proposals of any cities to ban the use of gas in homes. I mean, it just didn't even come up in any of the discussions I was in Columbus. But the gas industry wanted to get in front of this. And it was, when the sponsor testified, it was pretty clear that they were reacting to cities committing to 100% renewable energy. It freaked them out. And so they pushed through House Bill 201, and that also passed. And that one actually takes away local control of cities. So somehow one was for local controls, one was against local control. It was only about preserving fossil fuels, either by cementing the place of fossil fuels or by trying to keep out renewables. I mean, it really shows you kind of these legislatures, who's paying the bills for these legislators. And in the state of Ohio, how powerful the oil and gas industry still is.
As far as phasing out gas in new construction, what exactly is the rationale behind that, forbidding gas installations in new construction? I mean, the gas infrastructure is already there. We know that gas is, not a renewable energy. It is a fossil fuel in limited supply, although mm-hmm. there could be ways to generate it through biomass and what have you. But it's considered to be relatively non-polluting, at least in terms of combustion. So why would there be a concern with gas and new construction that you'd want to phase out?
So gas is considered cleaner on the end where it's burned, but that's not taking into account what happens before it gets to the plant where it's burned. So the fracking and then the transportation, a lot of methane is leaked and lost in that process. Methane is 86 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. We have less than 10 years to cut carbon emissions in half, and so the last thing we need is to be putting more methane into the atmosphere. Also, fracking, which is where it comes from in Ohio, causes a lot of issues with water, with land, beyond, and just the kind of chemicals that are used in the fracking process, so beyond just carbon emissions. So in states like California, where they did this, the rationale was to basically keep down the methane pollutions and move everything. Electricity is a lot easier to convert to a renewable source, such as solar and wind. There is, as you mentioned, like biomass, but that can be controversial because, you know, cutting up trees and burning them is a form of biomass that's definitely not renewable. Sometimes a landfill can be capped, and the landfill gas that comes off of that can be considered renewable. Oberlin, for example, a lot of its, I think 86% of its electricity comes from landfill gas from three landfills in the area. But there's just not enough of that to supply all the gas that's currently heating all the homes and being used for cooking in the state. So, while it would be a long-term goal to move everything to electricity, that's just not even in the discussion right now in Ohio the way it is in other states.
So I want to get back to the bills that just passed in a moment, but a question just occurred to me about the conversion to electricity from gas and from oil and other fossil fuels. What about the energy distribution infrastructure, the wiring, the transformers, the power relay stations, etc.? If there's a greater reliance on electricity, will it reach a point where all of those facilities need to be updated and replaced?
Yeah, the grid needs to be updated and replaced anyway. Okay, not my area of expertise, I will confess, but from my understanding, there's several grids around the country. They would need to be better connected. You know, like Texas is one, and it was by itself, which is why you saw what happened there happen, both in the winter and the summer. That grid needs to be upgraded, but they need to be upgraded and better connected all the way across the United States. That would also help with this idea that renewable energy, the sun isn't always shining and the wind isn't always blowing, but if you have an upgraded grid and you have a lot of sources of renewable energy going onto that grid, well, maybe the sun isn't shining exactly where you are, but it's shining somewhere, and those electrons are being put on the grid and they're being moved around the country. That's part of, actually a big part of the Green New Deal is to upgrade the grid for these reasons.
What about the idea of local energy autonomy, such as through distributed generation, rooftop solar, community-owned smaller solar and wind farms? Does that factor into the grid upgrade? Or I've heard about a concept of mini-grids where mm-hmm. A little local area, say a portion of a zip code or a neighborhood or several square blocks, would be fed primarily by a locally controlled, locally owned, and locally generated grid.
Yeah, absolutely. Community solar, microgrids, distributed generation, that is definitely part of the solution. I don't mean to say that the utility scale solar projects that basically something like Senate Bill 52 is attacking, that those are the only solution. They are part of the solution, but so is the local microgrid and community solar. And in fact, we are talking with the city of Columbus. They are one of 80 cities or so in the state to have their own municipal utility. And so while it's hard to do community solar and microgrids with an investor-owned utility, and also under the PUCO regulations, it can be done by by municipal utilities. So we're talking to the Columbus Division of Power about this is the direction we need to move. It's in the climate plan. They are in turn hiring an engineering firm to help them figure out how to do it. Like you mentioned, the grids, it's going to require them to upgrade their grid. But this is the direction that the city wants to move in and that we want them to move in, because it can, if we had a community solar project, that makes that neighborhood where that project is much more resilient if, you know, electricity goes out elsewhere. Microgrids make us much more resilient, and this could be done in low-income areas to cut the cost of energy for people. So absolutely, distributed energy is part of the solution.
That's a good segue into another question I wanted to ask, but the reason I asked about the microgrids and the distributed generation strategy is because I think what most people think about solar, at least, maybe also a little bit about wind, they think in terms of individual units, individual mm-hmm. houses and buildings being powered by these renewable energy technologies, not so much the larger scale commercial developments mm-hmm. that can supply an entire city with at least a portion of its electricity. Mm-hmm. Do the two bills that just passed threaten individual installations in any way? Is there any reason why people seeking to install solar panels or small turbines on their own buildings feel daunted by this?
As far as I know, no. These have no effect on rooftop solar or individual renewable energy, moving to that. And people, by all means, who can do that should do that. Unfortunately, rooftop solar doesn't work for a lot of people. Like anyone who rents, it's difficult. And a lot of roofs, if you have large trees shading your roof, or if your roof isn't facing south or west, then it's a lot harder to do individual rooftop solar. So that's where a community solar project comes in. The way that works is there might be one solar, like a small solar array, say 5 megawatts, in a field somewhere, and then people, the neighboring homes and churches and schools, would buy into that, and they would do that through what's called virtual net metering. So as much as they buy into that grid, it gets discounted on their bill. And so that's something that, like I was saying before, a municipal utility can sponsor such a project.
And you mentioned low-income neighborhoods being the beneficiaries of smaller models like that. What is being done now in Columbus to address that issue? Because I know we have a lot of gentrification. I see a lot of stacked shipping container-like apartment buildings going mm-hmm. up everywhere, and none of them seem to have any kind of solar panels or turbines or anything visible. There isn't a requirement for new construction to achieve those levels of efficiency that I know of, mm-hmm. And yet they get approved almost rubber stamped without hesitation. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, older, lower income neighborhoods are getting displaced, are getting blighted, neglected, etc., in terms of the distribution of city services. Is there an uphill battle to try to get the city to focus on those neighborhoods, and how can people help steer projects in that direction?
Yeah, that's something we've been talking to the city a lot about every time there's a meeting about how to do this. And that's actually a lot of what the grants from the Community Choice Aggregation Program will go for. The Clean Energy Columbus Program is an easier way of saying it, but that program's going to generate about $1.7 million a year in grants out of putting like 0.1 cents on people's power bills, and that will be used to generate this grant money. And so the city is just now kind of putting together the programs that grant money will be used for, and it will be energy efficiency upgrades for low-income people. The city did 30,000 home energy audits in the last 2 years, primarily in low-income areas, and now this money will be used to actually help people put in the extra insulation or upgrade their appliances or seal their windows, things that will help there. And then also, I think there's discussion of using that money for maybe kind of a green bank for larger energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. But for the new builds, you're absolutely right. And this is something that I've said to the city whenever I've had the chance, is if we're giving tax abatements for new construction, then those buildings better be LEED certified or net zero. Like, we need to be getting something out of those tax breaks. With buildings in general, energy efficiency is the most, I guess, the lowest hanging fruit, and it, you know, really cuts into the energy use and therefore cuts carbon emissions. And Columbus is making big strides on energy efficiency. Buildings are the top source of emissions in Columbus at 57%, but we are making strides in cutting those carbon emissions. In Columbus, this brings in a whole different matter. What is causing our emissions not to go down overall is transit and transportation, because a lot of people are moving here and they're bringing their gas cars and they're driving their gas cars on our interstate because we don't have a great public transportation system like other cities do. So the future of climate action in Columbus really is public transit. Also, sidewalks, bike lanes, carpooling, flexible work arrangements where people can work from home, but having bus rapid transit, and I hope one day light rail, and really doing transit-oriented development so people can take the bus or the train to get to from their home to work to shopping or wherever they need to go. We need to be a much more transit-oriented city, and that's what's going to cut our carbon emissions in the long run.
So back to the bills for a minute. The one bill that prohibits cities from setting goals of getting free of gas, mm-hmm. per se, that would seem to preclude a policy on behalf of the city to get rid of gas. But mm-hmm. if the energy choices that the city makes, such as developing new commercial-scale renewable energy generation facilities, as well as grants for individual property owners to install solar panels and turbines and that sort of mm-hmm. thing, results in an overall reduction in the use of gas to the point where gas is no longer really efficient to distribute and market, and no longer profitable, in other words, for mm-hmm. the gas companies. Mm-hmm. Would that achieve approximately the same result, just a little more gradually?
It would certainly help. yeah, like you said, it prevents, so the exact language is that the city or county cannot issue any law or zoning code that limits, prohibits, or prevents people or businesses from obtaining natural gas or propane. But if it's incentivized other sources of energy, or, you know, it just can't outright ban it. And so that probably would include if they said we're committing to 100% renewable energy and not just electricity, but all energy. Like, it probably, it takes aim at the Ready for 100 commitments that we've been seeking across the state.
Now, are these the only two bills that you know of that do target those aspirations, or is there other legislation coming down the pike that we can expect? And how do we find out about these things enough in advance so that citizens can organize and take some action?
Right. Those are really good questions. The main other bill, which is still pending, that deals directly with energy is House Bill 282. And so what that would do is, so when there's fracking, millions of tons of water is, shoved into the earth to break apart the rock. And that's filled with lots of chemicals, and it goes down into the earth. It fracks the rocks there to release the gas in there that's then collected. And then that water comes back up and it's wastewater. Nothing can be done with it because of all the chemicals in it. But it also brings up radioactive materials that are in the ground. So for the last several years, some counties have been using that water as a de-icer in the winter to de-ice the roads. House Bill 282 would allow that water to be sold under the brand named Aqua Salina, or there may be others, for just regular citizens like your neighbors to buy and put on their driveway. And then it would just run into the ground and into the water, and it's radioactive. and so there's been a great protest against that bill, so it hasn't passed yet, but it is expected to come up again in September. The best way I know of to keep track of all these bills is to sign up for the mailing list of the groups that are working on these bills. And it's slightly different every season, every bill, but I would just sign up for all of them. Sign up for a Buckeye Environmental Network. Sign up for Green Energy Ohio. Sign up for Ohio Environmental Council. Sign up for Ohio Sierra Club. Sign up for my group, Simply Living. And, if one of them isn't working on it, probably others are. And
I've attended a lot of hearings at the State House over various bills, and usually there is a public audience allowed, sometimes even allowed to participate through questions or testimonies and what have you. And I know that some of these bills have passed in camera of the public, where the public was actually not allowed to attend, where they weren't publicized at all. But even so, that's a very arduous thing to do. It's a big commitment of time. You have to go to a town, you have to park, you have to sit uncomfortably, listen to a lot of technical jargon before the meat of the issue comes up, and then everyone else says their say, and you're basically consigned to sitting there fidgeting quietly and in frustration. And it's not even really much of a show of concern or support, at least not that seems to affect the legislators. Other than attending hearings, what actions can citizens take when they do find out about an objectionable bill?
Right. Well, you can always do written testimony if you can't physically attend. It's probably got more impact if you physically attend and give your testimony in person. But you can also send in written. But you can also just call your representative or your senator, because that's where your voice is going to be the strongest, because you're the ones who vote for them. So I certainly did that with both of mine, and both of my House rep and Senate. My senator are both Republicans, but they both listened to me, and both of them actually voted against these bills. So it's not a hopeless cause. And then otherwise, you know, write to your legislator, write to the members of the committee, whatever committee these bills are in. It is difficult and arduous to go down there, and it is difficult and arduous to find out when these hearings are. Like, you have to know which committee, you have to be on that committee mailing list. There were many times just this past month where they called a committee hearing like 2 days later, and you had maybe 1 day's notice, maybe. And of course, we all have jobs, we have lives, you don't always have time to put together testimony. So that's another reason to sign up for these environment group mailing lists, because they'll probably be sending out action alerts on the really important ones. They'll have a form letter that you could just send, or you could personalize a little bit, but it's not quite as arduous. Just, you know, whatever level of commitment you can do is fantastic.
Just give me the warm power of the sun. Give me the steady flow of a waterfall. Give me the spirit of living things. Say return to clay. Just give me the restless power of a wind. Give me the comforting glow of a wood fire. But please take all of your atomic poison power away. Everybody needs some power, I'm told, shield them from the darkness and the cold.
Some may see a way to take control when it's bought and sold.
I know that lives are at stake, yours and mine, and our descendants in time. There's so much to gain, so much to lose. Every one of us has a choice. Just give me the warm power of the sun. So little time to change our ways. And only we together can say, to just give me the warm power of the sun. Give me the steady flow of a waterfall. Give me the spirit of living things. Say, return to clay. Just give me the restless power of the wind. Give me the comforting glow of a wood fire. Take all of your atomic oil.
I don't know if there are any legal challenges in the works that may try to overturn those bills, or if there are other legal and legislative strategies being developed to work around them, but you can be sure we'll be following that story here. When the Keystone XL pipeline was defeated, environmental activists around the world breathed a partial sigh of relief. It seemed a blow was struck, even if a largely symbolic one, on the fight against continuing reliance on fossil fuels. But the Keystone was just one branch of a metastasizing network of pipelines crisscrossing the Great Plains and meandering all the way down to the southern seaports and the east coast of Florida, cutting wide swaths of deforestation and devalued properties, threatening aquifers and surface water, wildlife, and people's livelihoods, all for temporary gains by the oil and gas companies, whose petroleum joyride is drawing to an ignominious close, as remaining reserves of crude and oil and natural gas are dwindling, or like the tar sands of Canada, which both the Keystone and the Enbridge 3 pipeline, now under construction, are intended to carry, require more and more intensive and polluting technologies to refine. Last week, three women from Athens, Ohio, decided they needed to take action, so they traveled to Minnesota and joined Native American activists in not only protesting the Enbridge pipeline, but laying their bodies and freedom on the line to do it.
So now I'll start asking you. Go ahead.
Hello, Evan. My name is Judy Smucker. I live here in Athens. Hello, I'm Ann Sparks, and I live here in Athens, in the Athens area.
Hi, I'm Claudia Sheehan, and I'm also from this area.
So the three of you traveled to Minnesota recently to protest the construction of a pipeline that maybe not everyone has heard about. Of course, everyone's heard of the Keystone Pipeline, largely because of the protests over that. And people may have, certainly if they've been listening to this show, familiarized themselves with some of the environmental impacts of not only the pipeline, but also the increased oil consumption that pipelines would facilitate. But this pipeline was not the Keystone Pipeline. Tell us a little bit about how you found out about this pipeline and what motivated you to go all the way to Minnesota to protest.
Hello, this is Anne. I found out about Line 3, which is what this pipeline is called, some time ago when I was following some Native American people, some indigenous people, talking about protecting their land and their way of life, especially cultivating the wild rice in Minnesota. So these are the Ojibwe people. And Winona LaDuke is a very well-known activist. And along with other things that she was talking about that I was following, this was mentioned. However, I only recently learned more about it and how this particular period is so crucial, because they are expanding the pipeline, although they're pretending that it's just a replacement of a pipeline that has failed. They're actually taking a new route through an area that is the headwaters of the Mississippi, where a lot of lakes, streams, and wetlands are vulnerable, as well as that area where the wild rice is cultivated, but also where, being the source of the Mississippi, this endangers the water source for a large part of the country, not just the state of Minnesota.
So the Keystone Pipeline was controversial in part because it crossed Native American lands and would have, or in fact did, desecrate some sacred areas. And of course, there was the environmental impact. But that pipeline never actually got built. Some preparation was done, but the pipeline never actually got laid per se, or at least not completed. What stage is this pipeline at?
This pipeline brings a substance called tar sands, which a lot of people refer to as sludge. It's not a really good source of petroleum. It's very expensive to transport it, and it's very expensive to turn it into any kind of usable substance. But nevertheless, this is what they have been transporting, and they're only replacing, expanding part of their pipeline. So in other words, this is an ongoing enterprise of this corporation called Enbridge, bringing these tar sands from Canada and then building the pipelines to get the tar sands to the refineries that will, they expect, make it into a marketable product, or at least up until now, they believe it is doing so. So the whole enterprise is very suspicious, given the difficulty of extracting what can be used from this sludge material and the destruction that is being caused because of it.
Well, talking about that destruction, of course, people are familiar with the byproducts of combusting oil or oil petroleum products. We know that that is polluting. It releases greenhouse gases into the atmosphere as well as other pollutants. And then we've heard, of course, about transportation issues, either by vehicle, train, or truck. There are often spills associated with that, sometimes fires and catastrophic explosions. But pipelines, too, have their issues. They rupture, they explode, they burn, they cause massive leaks. What is the record of this particular company?
Enbridge does not have a good record. In fact, they're saying the justification for this expansion, which they call a replacement, is the failure of the section that they want to no longer use. In terms of the emissions, I've heard the statistic that they are planning on transporting up to 900,000 barrels a day, and a barrel equals 42 gallons. So that comes to 38 million gallons a day, which is coming the dirtiest fossil fuel on Earth, and then what is it going to cause? Emissions equal to the emissions from 50 coal power plants.
Sure. So the destruction that we're talking about, though, with regard to the pipeline per se, also involves a lot of deforestation, I understand, and altering of the landscape. I know listeners to this program will recall that we covered a pipeline in Florida and did a little walk and talk with one of the activists there protesting. I forget the name of that particular pipeline, but it was some 500-mile long facility that stretched from Georgia or through the state of Georgia all the way into Florida. And we saw part of the construction of that pipeline. It was a 100-foot-wide swath of clearance through a very densely vegetated jungle-like area. And it was just kind of a stripe of moonscape, you know, with sections of pipeline and downed trees lying all around and big pockets of mud. What about in Minnesota? What did you actually see part of where the pipeline was being constructed there?
We saw areas all along the major highways, and we know that beyond that there are other areas where huge deforestation has taken place. And of course, heavy machinery coming in is also very damaging. We had an opportunity to learn from the indigenous people about what they have seen, and they described very movingly a lake that had been drained because not only are places where they're drilling being destroyed, but they're also emptying lakes and streams and wetlands for the amount of water they claim they need for the whole project. And this lake had been completely drained, and the wildlife and the birds were completely disoriented. And this is something that is part of the sacred approach to nature and Mother Earth on the part of the indigenous people. So we found that very moving.
So you traveled to Minnesota to protest the construction of this particular leg of the pipeline. Why did you choose this pipeline? I mean, I know there are other pipelines that are also being built, but what drew you to this particular one?
Well, I think I started watching videos of what was happening up there, and it was just so destructive. I couldn't believe this was going on and nobody was helping the indigenous people who have been fighting this for 7 years, trying to keep this pipeline out of there. And they're just calling for help. They're saying, please come, help us. They have tried to teach us a way of life that would sustain us. And we are not listening. We're not listening to our Mother Earth. Mother Earth is being destroyed right in front of our eyes, and we're not aware of it. These people are trying to wake us up. And I felt like pipeline number three was the one that needed our help. And they've been fighting it all these years. It's time for us to put out a little bit, to get up there and get whatever support we can. I mean, it's just the three of us that went.
But they were so, so appreciative. They are so appreciative for any help that they can get from people who will join them and fight this pipeline. It's destroying their economy. It's destroying their way of life.
I guess I ask that because I'm aware that there's another pipeline passing very close to here through Athens or near Athens. And to my knowledge, that one has not attracted the same degree of protest.
We've just kind of learned about it. I don't know why it has kind of out of my view. I wasn't aware of it. We talked about it on our ride up there, and we thought, yes, we've got to protect this pipeline that's coming in or protect the area where this other pipeline is coming in West Virginia. And we are definitely going to look into that because it's closer, it'd be easier to go, and we're in the mode now. We want to do it. We want to help these. This is a destruction to our earth that has to be stopped. This is destroying our earth. The excavation it just has to be stopped.
So you traveled to Minnesota, I assume, and were joined there by other protesters from around the country?
Yes, we stayed in a camp with many protesters, beautiful young people who are shouldering this responsibility of stopping this pipeline, and they were terribly, wonderfully inspiring for me. I'm just so sad that this is what they're having to spend their youth doing. We messed up the planet, and now they're trying to fix it. And it's not just about the pipeline for me. It was about the indigenous people and their fight for their treaty rights that have just totally been ignored. This pipeline's going right through sacred areas. And to be honest, I think all land to the indigenous people is sacred. They treat it as sacred. This is their wild rice areas. This is their economy, too. And I think that's what attracted me, was that, you know, they're a small group. They're not huge. And they've been arrested so many times in this fight. They can't put themselves on the line much more, or we're not going to see them. They're going to be put in jail. We need new people to go up there who are willing to help them and willing to stand in the front lines for them.
So you went up realizing that you might be engaging in some kind of a civil disobedience there and could be facing arrest. Tell me what happened. What did you experience there during the protests?
Well, when we got there, since, you know, the three of us are older, grandmother age, we were welcomed with open arms. And most of the people there at the camp were young people who had been fighting this for a long time. And they just felt like having us there was another generation giving them support. And as we looked around and saw all these young people, they were giving up everything, you know, their education, their livelihood. And here we were, you know, at this time in our life, we needed to encourage more people our age and all ages. It doesn't make any difference what your age is. You have to come up and support these young people who are fighting for their future. They are truly fighting for their future. If you think that climate crisis is not real, you have to read more about it. You have to find out. It's climate crisis is a catastrophe that's happening to all of us, not just to the indigenous people. We're all going to be affected, and we have to change the way our world runs. The fossil fuel companies have been making money off of the extraction for many, many years. They're making billions of dollars off of the extraction of Mother Earth and destroying our Earth where we live. We have to stop this destruction.
So you say that the young folks there that were protesting were putting themselves at a great deal of risk, risking livelihoods and that sort of thing, but you did as well. I mean, what exactly did you bring to the table as far as risk?
What did we bring to the table? You know, I just see what was given to me at the table. So many gifts were given to me, but We went up there and we knew we would probably be arrested. That was the purpose. Because if that's what counts, you don't get the attention of the media by saying, oh, would you please stop this pipeline? That doesn't work. It's been tried over and over again. This is a movement and it takes putting yourself at risk. And yeah, we got arrested and we're here back home now. And we're back in our safety of our community and our comfortable houses. And there are still so many people up there that are not going home. They're staying for the fight and they need help.
So the arrests, I assume, are ongoing as the protest is ongoing. Were you mishandled as you were taken into custody? How did that go?
I'm white. I'm an older woman. I was treated well. Even saying that, though, it's not an easy experience to go to jail. It's not easy to put yourself on the line. I know there are a lot of those young people are brown, black, just all walks of life, and I worry for their safety because I know they're not being treated the same way I was treated. There's definitely a difference. The Native Americans that I talk to, when they talk about going into booking rooms, they're shackled. We weren't shackled. So that's our privilege, and I accept that. I understand that happens, but it doesn't happen for everybody up there.
And so what were you charged with? What were you doing at the time that you were arrested?
Can we talk about it?
Yes, we can.
Well, we were charged with a felony. They said that we stole the gate. I didn't realize that I had stolen the gate, but that was the charge, the most important one, of course, is the felony charge. And then trespassing. I don't know what other charges. They threw a bunch of them at us. We'll let it all sift out eventually. But I would do it again. I would do it in a second. I felt like what we did made a difference. I can't believe that we're actually doing an interview right here today. I never thought it would come to this. We wanted to do our little bit, our little part, and I'm finding out that a lot of people don't know about Pipeline 3. They don't know how we are at a tipping point. Our earth is at a tipping point. And the decisions we make today, they are going to affect our future. Our future, it's going to affect the future of our grandchildren. That's what we're worried about, our grandchildren. What kind of a life are they going to have on this earth when it's polluted and the air is polluted, the water is polluted? You know, I used to be able to go swimming in the lakes and the rivers. Our kids can't do that. If everything's polluted, we've got to clean up this earth. We can't live like this. It's not going to continue. It's not going to sustain life. Life on this earth may be over in the next, what are they estimating? It's scary to talk about it. It's heartbreaking. When I think about my grandchildren living up in an earth that is being destroyed by pollution, it's truly heartbreaking.
So did you lock yourselves down at the gate? How many people were involved there?
The day before we were arrested, there was a huge protest, and 28 people were arrested. Many young people locked themselves to equipment, to gates. They had a lot of support people that went to jail along with them. That was the big action, and that was Thursday. On Friday, it was just the three of us, the grandmothers. We locked ourselves to a gate that was the pipe yard where all the pipe was stored. And we stopped trucks from coming and going. And but that's just one action. There are so many actions. There's so many things going on. There was one this week where they used canoes in the river, where they watched a river with an aquifer that got hit by the pipeline coming up through the river. And they were documenting this. You know, people up there doing all kinds of actions. It's just not one type. It's many, many types. And it's not like you have to go up there just to get arrested. That's not necessary. You can go up and support in many ways. There's so many ways to plug in and help this movement.
So you're charged with felonies. What are the possible penalties or fines that you're facing now?
We don't know. we're waiting to find out. It's a waiting game. Yeah. Hurry up and wait. That's the motto up there.
And you have attorneys that are advising you, I'm sure.
Yes, we have contact with an attorney. And we also, through the movement, have a wonderful jail support people who have followed us through the whole thing, or keeping in touch with us, making sure our needs are going to get met. Yes, they don't abandon you once you're arrested. You still have a huge group of support behind you.
So what was the overall value of your traveling from Ohio all the way to Minnesota to do the protest there? I mean, aren't there other people closer by, including older folks who would have this, approximately the same kind of impact?
Well, I know why I went. I have grandchildren, and I want to show them that I tried. If nothing else, I tried, and that's important to me. And the value is how much I learned. I learned so much. I was taught much more than I gave, and I know that.
Yeah, I think we need to think about what our future generations are going to look back at our generation and say, did we do everything that we could do to stop this destruction? It's a powerful thing to think about. Our children thinking about us as people who didn't care. This is the generation where we filled our oceans with plastics, where we cut down our forests. This is the way we're going to be remembered. I can't fathom that. I can't think that this is the way our generation is going to be remembered. I'd like to think that the new century, the 21st century, will be one of cleaning things up, realizing what we've done, clean up the mess. We have got to change, and we have to change now. You know, changing slowly is not going to win. We have to change now. We can't, if we do it slowly, we've lost. We have to make big changes now.
Now, the Biden administration had a role in stopping the Keystone Pipeline. What do you make of the current administration's positioning with regard to this pipeline or pipelines in general?
Call Biden. Give him a call. That's what I have to say. Let him know where you stand on this. He needs to wake up. He needs to go up there. He needs to see it from his own eyes. You have to see what's going on. It's a scar on our planet. You can contact Biden by going to whitehouse.gov/contact. Let him know how you feel. This is important.
Did you take any encouragement from the appointment of Deb Haaland as Interior Minister?
Yes, we did, definitely. And they're calling for her to come up to Pipeline 3. She hasn't come up yet. We're hoping that she will make a statement. We don't know. I haven't heard anything.
And how can people find out more about the efforts to stop this pipeline particularly? Are there certain organizations behind the main drive here?
Yes, there's many Facebook pages. There's Honor the Earth. They have a lot of information on the GIWIN, GIWIN Collective. That's on Facebook. Just Google it. It's there. I mean, there's a lot of information out there. You have to find it, but it's there.
And that's Enbridge Pipeline Line 3. Mm-hmm. And when will you know the next steps in your legal status with regard to the charges? Is there a hearing coming up soon? What should listeners be looking for?
I think we tried to call this morning. They still didn't have any information to give us. They said, didn't they say they would contact us?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're thinking, what is the strategy of not letting us know? I think they want us to not come back because we don't know what our status is. Mm-hmm. So we better stay home until we find out. We don't know, but it just seems like it's not, you know, they should be able to give us some information, and they haven't been able to.
Our bail release was $10,000 reduced to $5,000 with the understanding that we'd stay away from Enbridge property. So in a way, they've bullied us. We're a little afraid to go back up. We don't want to anger them any farther. I don't want to look at jail time. So yeah, it's a hurry up and wait game. You hurry up and wait. We see what happens. We were supposed to be arraigned on Tuesday. We called, they said Thursday, we called, they're saying next week. So the longer they can drag this out, and if they do this with all the protesters, the longer they can drag it out, the pipeline can get built, and people can't put themselves on the line if they have arrest pendings. So, yeah, I think it's the wait game now.
Would you have to return to Minnesota for the arraignment?
They're talking about Zoom maybe, but depending on what they want to do, we're at whatever they want. If we can Zoom, that would be great. If not, we'll be in person back up there.
All right. And I always ask if there's anything I failed to cover, anything I didn't ask about, anything you'd like to add.
Well, I would like to say that I first kind of really became serious about what was happening to Mother Earth when I listened to a young girl at the 1992 Earth Climate Convention in Rio. This 13-year-old girl, Sven Suzuki was her name, and she warned us then, this is 30 years ago, that we adults are destroying their future. She said she and her father go fishing a lot in Canada. She lives in Canada, and they're catching fish now that were filled with cancers, and they could see that plastic was everywhere, that people just buy and throw away. They're no concern about Mother Earth and about the extraction. In 1992, she warned us about this, and I would suggest everybody go and listen to her video because it reminds me so much of Greta today. Young people trying to tell us, please clean up our mess. Clean up your mess, people. We can't live in a world like this.
Always inspiring when people who had not been accustomed to radical actions step up and sacrifice to lend substance to their convictions, as those three women have. By the way, you can learn more about the local protests and fundraising efforts regarding the Enbridge pipeline and other environmental threats by visiting the website of the Athens County Future Action Network, or AFCAN, at acfan.org. You'll find action alerts there and several articles about the folks whose interview you just heard. This has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WGRNLP 94.1 FM and WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care.
Coal, oil, gas. None of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the trains around. Coal, oil, gas. None of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the trains around. Cascadia is a place of great. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the trains around. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the trains around. Coal. Leave it in the ground, turn the trains around. We are a people awakening, none of these are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding, turn the trains around. We are a people. We'll be right back.
The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.